presented The World at One, The World This Weekend, and has taken over the presentation of Sunday's Radio 4's main religious news and current affairs programme. So I really welcome him here tonight. He is one of Britain's greatest journalists. And welcome.
No pressure then. I've reached the stage where that sort of introduction is really a reminder of how old I am. Thank you very much. I should say, Helena has just reminded me that in the tablet last week she was tipped as one of the first women cardinals for May. That's how you can call her Your Eminence throughout the evening.
I can't tell you how that would shock my mother. My mother, when I told my mother I was going into the Lords, she thought I said I was going to Lourdes. And she was so shocked that I was going to Lourdes. But the Lords was, you know, small beer after that.
I think you look fantastic in scarlet.
Well.
just sticking with the theme of great antiquity, just begin by recalling when I joined Independent News as a trainee back in 1979, and a couple of weeks afterwards I was greeted in the newsroom one morning with the cheery shout, "Oi, you, trainee, grab a crew, go to Brixton and find an escaped prisoner." Well, the tabloids had run a piece that morning claiming that prison inmates were nipping out over the wall in the evening to enjoy a drink or two in the pub, so it was my job to stand up in the story. One of the disconcerting things about listening to old reports from that era is that we all sound like the Queen, especially if, like me, you went to public school in Oxbridge. And being a nicely brought up young man of the era, I'd come to work in the suit. So resplendent in pinstripe, I spent the day sidling up to burly men in pubs saying, "Ear, mate.
Are you having an hour or two out?
Would you like a pint?" And it didn't have to be an escaped prisoner from the Nick, do you? It wasn't my finest hour. Not long afterwards, the Tory MP, Winston Churchill, son of the great man, was caught having a love affair with Soraya Khashoggi, who was the widow of a notorious Saudi arms dealer. And the fact that, the allegation I should perhaps say, that he'd driven at 100 miles an hour down an American freeway with Mrs. Khashoggi telling him, "The faster you go, the more I take off," made the story irresistible to my news desk, and I was sent down to the House of Commons with my camera crew to ask him what he thought about all this. Unsurprisingly, he didn't turn up for work that day, but I was spotted by a Cambridge contemporary who berated me for going along with this prurient assignment. "Was this really," he asked, "a worthy use of 3 years in the Fens studying Chaucer and the English novel?" And I slunk away in shame. The final searing memory of that period shows I had at least learned a few journalistic wiles. It happened while I was working as what we call a fixer in those days, don't probably say a field producer, covering the Darlington by-election of 1983. This was the heyday of the SDP, the centrists who broke away from the Labour Party of Yorkshire. A Darlington victory for the SDP would mark a milestone on the road to a third force in British politics. That didn't happen, but in the course of the campaign, the cricketer Ian Botham said after a cricket tour that Pakistan was the sort of place you'd like to send your mother-in-law. Those of us with bien pensant internationalist views on the world were shocked that so prominent a figure could insult a country like that. The ITN news desk editors were more excited by the insult to his mother-in-law, who happened to live near Darlington. At least by that stage, I learned when the phone call came, I'd learned to invent a very urgent SDP press conference, which would keep me from going to talk to her. The point of those anecdotes, apart from being therapeutic corrective to nostalgia, is that, to illustrate really the point, the ITN newsroom in those days was certainly not a high-minded place. News, we were taught, was about stories, and the more human, the better. We were to answer the basic journalistic questions: who, what, when, where, and to leave the more complex stuff like why and what did it mean to the eggheads of the BBC. There was a mythical character called Mum in Wigan. Why Wigan? I've no idea. Perhaps it was because there was some dim collective memory of Warren's Road to Wigan Pier, but Mum in Wigan, we were told, was our target. Would this story appeal to her? Would it interest her? Had we told it in a way that she could understand? And yet, despite all that self-consciously tabloid stuff, the journalistic principles I learned back at ITN in those days were rock solid, and I value them more the longer I work in this business, and they're really the inspiration for the title of this talk. The newsroom in those days was a rum cocktail. The staff were a mixture of glamorous foreign correspondents who might have stepped out of the pages of Scoop. First time I was sent a shadow of a reporter, a very good-looking young John Snow drew up in an open-top sports car and swept me off. Then there were the theoretically brainy Oxbridge types. And finally, the hard-nosed middle-aged men, and they were mostly men then, who'd come up via the School of Hard Knocks working on papers like The Mail and The Mirror. And this disparate crew were united by one thing, the overriding principle that I've hinted at in my title. Accuracy mattered more than anything. And the Hard Knocks types like ramming this message home to the Oxbridge trainees by assigning us to type out the football results for the newsreaders to read out on News at 10. It was explained to us, in case we'd missed this, well, locked away in our ivory towers like this one, that the viewers minded very much about their football teams. And there was money at stake too. This was the golden era of football pools in the pre-lottery days when betting on the outcome of league games was a national ritual. So getting the football results wrong was regarded as one of the very few things that could get you sacked. Indeed, there was a folk memory, probably untrue, but it was a good story anyway, that one bright young Oxbridge lad paid the ultimate price because he thought that Division was the name of a team. So wrote out Division 1, Chelsea 0. Couldn't understand why there was a name left over when he got to the end of the list. The lesson we were supposed to learn from the football scores duty was this. If you make what you may think is a trivial mistake in a subject the viewers know about, the subs told us, they'll never trust you when it comes to the big things they don't know about. And it was about as close to an abstract statement as these grizzled old pros got. But it was profoundly wise. No media organisation can survive without the trust of its viewers, listeners or readers, as the staff of the now-defunct News of the World will tell you, and learn to their cost. Now, you can easily check a football result. It's either right or it's wrong. You probably wouldn't say it's true, would you? You might say it's true that Chelsea beat Manchester United or something of that kind, but it seems to me you'd be much more likely to use the word true or truth in relation to a football match in an interpretive way. Well, the truth is that from the moment the offside decision went against us, we were done for, or the truth is that the Manchester United have never really recovered from losing Alex Ferguson. I should say the subs were completely right about me. I have no idea about football, so if I say something quite ludicrous, do forgive me. But that brings me to the distinction between accuracy and truth, which I've drawn in the title for this talk. I'm conscious that it's a pretty crude distinction. You'll certainly catch me oversimplifying to make my point. I wouldn't dream of trying to make any kind of philosophical statement, certainly not here. The title's really just a conceit, if you like, to try and explore some of the lessons I've learnt in, as Helena said, a frighteningly long career in this job. In journalism and in the public discourse on which it draws, truth is, in my experience, a slippery slope, frankly. When people use the word, very often what they mean is interpretation or conviction about a set of events rather than the facts that can be tested for accuracy in the way a football result can. I have, for example, interviewed Tony Blair about Iraq a number of times, both before, during and after the conflict. And I've never once seen him shaken in his conviction that his view of the episode is the true one. Now, probably because I've started down that way, you're going to expect me to deliver a tirade against the iniquities of the spin culture of the Blair, Alistair Campbell era, but actually I'm not, because I want to use the Iraq episode to illustrate a rather different point. In the immediate aftermath of the Afghan war, I made a Radio 4 series called With Us or Against Us, an insider's account, as we like to say in our biddings, of the way the Americans assembled such a powerful coalition of support for military action in Afghanistan following the events of September the 11th. It worked, at least I think it worked, for two reasons. The first was good luck, or at least good timing. This was the spring of 2002, and it seems an extraordinary thing to recall now, but at the time, the Bush administration was riding very high indeed, and the Afghan campaign was seen as an extraordinary success, really, a groundbreaking success. Everyone wanted to climb aboard the American train. So almost everyone we asked for an interview, Condoleezza Rice in Washington, Sergei Lavrov, the foreign minister in Moscow, President Musharraf in Pakistan, King Abdullah in the Middle East, certainly Messrs. Blair and Straw here, agreed to talk to us. The second reason it worked goes back to those high-tier lessons about storytelling. We didn't ask people for their opinions, we asked them to tell us what they did and said, who, what, where, when questions. Where were you when you heard about the attacks on the Twin Towers? What did you say when you rang up the Russian foreign minister? Tell me about that NATO meeting which you attended. Now, of course, people like to put the best gloss on what they did. But if you ask them very straight, simple questions like that, you do get closer to the football score's version of history, to a narrative that you can actually judge whether it's accurate or not. And we found, for example, that sometimes we could put together two sides of the same telephone conversation, and if you do that and they tend to agree, you can be reasonably sure that you've got an accurate picture of what was said. You also, if you conduct enough interviews with the right people, begin to see a pattern emerging. And although this was, as I say, the summer of 2002, it was pretty clear from the evidence that we gathered that the American focus would soon move to Iraq, and that a war there was pretty much inevitable. It was just the details that were telling. The British ambassador at the time remembering the night that he and Tony Blair went to dinner at the White House just after 9/11, and remember being startled by how much Iraq was talked about even at that early stage. All the people who'd been with Bush at the emergency meeting he convened at Camp David after 9/11, remembering how much they debated whether to strike Iraq immediately or wait for a while. The assumption, which came through all our interviews, that after the enormity of 9/11, the United States had the right, and in fact the duty, to act unilaterally if it saw fit. So when you put the jigsaw puzzle together, it didn't take a genius to see that war was on the way. When the story was broadcast, I was asked to give a talk at the Church of St. Martin in the Fields in London about the series. And without, of course, expressing any view on whether I thought war was the right or the wrong thing, I laid out the evidence and said I thought it was the most accurate prediction. And I got metaphorically pelted with rotten eggs during the questions, because that conclusion was not what my audience wanted to hear. They were good, peace-loving Christian folk, fundamentally opposed to war, and what I was telling them ran contrary to what you might call their truth. And they didn't like it, and they wouldn't have it. And it's not just governments that are vulnerable to the temptation to decide on a truth and then look for facts to fit. Anyone with convictions, anyone not addicted to accuracy in the way I suggest cold-blooded journalists should be, will bring those convictions to bear in their judgment of what constitutes the truth about almost any matter of public controversy. And that evening made me reflect a bit on our duty as journalists. Should I have tried to persuade my audience that their understanding of truth was mistaken? Many of my colleagues would argue I should. Newspaper columnists, for example, certainly, who would of course count themselves as journalists, would say I should have done more than that and told them what I thought was right or wrong. But I don't think we should. And just to illustrate why, I'd like to say a little bit about a reporting assignment I came back from a couple of months ago. Next year marks the 80th anniversary of Mao's Long March, which is sometimes described as the founding myth of modern China. And in February on Radio 4, we're doing a series of three programmes in which we'll try and address the subject with some of those basic journalistic questions: what, where, when, how. I beg your pardon, who, what, where, when, in mind, but also some of the more complex ones, why and what did it mean. We retraced the route in September, and we're just finishing off the series at the moment. Not, I should say, the whole route, but as much as the BBC budget would allow over a fortnight's travel. Now, uniquely, in my experience, this story, it's been easier to answer, with this story, it's been easier to answer the more complex questions and to answer the basic ones. Why did the Long March happen? Well, that's easy. It happened because Mao and his section of the Communist Party had been bottled up in their heartland in southeast China by Chiang Kai-shek and would probably have been eliminated if they hadn't fled. The Long March was, to put it tactfully, a strategic retreat. What did it mean? Again, that's easy. It secured Mao's position as the leader of the Communist Party and gave him the propaganda narrative of struggle in adversity, which sustained him to his victory over the Nationalists in 1949, and right on through his time as a national leader. And it gave the Chinese a myth, and I use the word myth in the sense that Dunkirk and the Battle of Britain are myths for us, a myth on which to build a new sense of Chinese values after the humiliations inflicted on them by foreigners during the previous century. But the who, what, where, when questions, these were altogether more difficult to answer. We can say with reasonable certainty that the march began when 86,000 men and women crossed the Yudu River in October 1934, and we can also say that Mao declared it over when a shockingly shrunken Red Army force, the figures generally put at between 4,000 and 8,000, reached Shanxi province a year later. But recreating an accurate picture of what happened in between is incredibly difficult because, and this was something that simply never occurred to me before I started work on this project, there are very, very few contemporary documents about what happened. If you were trying to reconstruct a movement of 86,000 troops during the First World War, you'd have a huge variety of sources to draw on. Letters, trench diaries, Whitehall documents, military orders, perhaps letters in the Times, questions in the House of Commons. But most of the long marchers were illiterate, so they couldn't write home or keep diaries. The party was on the move all the time, and the last thing they began to do was lug around the filing cabinets. And anyway, there wasn't much paper available. There are photographs of Mao and the other leaders taken in Jiangxi before the march began, and of course there are others taken of them in Yan'an after it was over. But as far as I know, there's absolutely no photographic record at all, certainly not a substantial one, of the march itself. So that vacuum, that lack of documentary evidence, is of course a spinner's dream. It means you can tell the story as you would like to, and makes the official version very difficult to challenge. And unsurprisingly, the Communist Party has exploited that to the full. If you want to penetrate the carapace of Communist Party spin, of its version of the truth about the march, to build up an accurate picture of what happened, the only way you can really do it is by relying on oral history. And in this case, that largely means folk memories, because most of the marchers, of course, are dead, which is a very difficult thing to do. In Jiangxi, for example, where the march began, we were the guests of the provincial government, which meant we were incredibly well looked after. Every meal was a banquet, including breakfast and involved toasts. Everything was laid on for us to see, but it was almost impossible to do anything independently. However, our brilliant Chinese translator managed to track down a man whose family home in Yudu had been used as a billet for Red Army soldiers. And we slipped out early one morning before our breakfast banquet to go and see him. Like so much of modern China, Yudu is now a forest of skyscrapers, but this house was one of the very few remaining traditional houses tucked away in the back streets. Part of the Communist Party narrative about the Long March is that the marchers were highly motivated, true believers in communism. And sure enough, on the walls of this house were all sorts of uplifting slogans that the soldiers had written out extolling the virtues of Marxism. But among them was one completely arresting piece of graffiti. A wonderfully expressive scribbled drawing of a young kid with a gun. And I asked our host about it. He, I should say, was too young to have been there himself, but his father had told him the stories. And he said, well, yes, of course, that's because all the soldiers were youngsters. In fact, they were teenagers, scarcely more than children. And it's one of those sort of moments when you feel you've touched something, because it told us where to look. When you do examine what evidence there is closely, it's apparent that a high proportion of Mao's Red Army were what today we would call child soldiers. And that many of them joined not because they were inspired by communism, but because it was the only way they could get anything to eat. In Yan'an, where the march ended, we talked to the daughter of one of the women long marchers, and her mother had died a couple of years earlier, but she passed on her memories. And in 1934, she was orphan of, as far as she could remember, 11 or 12, living with her brother in a village in Sichuan. And the Red Army came through and put on a propaganda performance in the street where she was playing with her friends. Seeing that she was impressed, they said, come on, little sister, why don't you join us? She was given a good scrubbing, a uniform, a new name. She couldn't remember her own surname. She wasn't allowed to go back to her house to say goodbye to her brother. And a couple of days later, she began to miss her brother and her village and said she wanted to go home. They said, you can't, it's too late. She was effectively kidnapped. And she never found her brother or her village again, even though she lived to be a 90-year-old. She also had the bad luck to have been taken by a section of the Red Army, which marched three times across the notorious Great Swamp, where soldiers who missed their footing were sucked into the mud and died. And do forgive this detail, but where hunger was so intense that each wave of soldiers would look for the feces of those who'd gone before so they could pick out and wash any undigested grain. I'm not going to tell you the whole story of our series, that's quite enough, it goes out. In case you're interested, 11 o'clock on Radio 4, Wednesday, 26th of February. But the same message came through all the interviews we did again and again. The story is much, much darker than the official history would allow. A Chinese journalist called Sun Shuyun found the same thing when she did a much more comprehensive version of what we did. She travelled the whole route 10 years ago when there were more people around who remembered it firsthand, and she turned up. Extraordinarily moving testimony from women marchers who'd been captured by the nationalists, raped and forced to serve as concubines, and then rejected by the Communist Party's collaborators after the Communist victory of 1949. But she found, as did we, that no one, not even those who'd seen the worst of it, wanted to question the value of the official Communist Party account of the march as a glorious struggle. One of the women, for example, she interviewed, sadly now dead, was expelled from the party in 1939 as a collaborator after being used as a concubine and spent the next 40 years trying to get back into it because the party meant so much to her. And you sit down with someone and listen to this harrowing accounts of how badly young men and women were treated on the march. And then you say, well, doesn't that make you question the official version or wonder whether it was worthwhile? And they would say no. And I think that reinforces my conviction that we have to be modest about our ambitions in journalism. Some of what I found out on this project I found extremely disturbing, and it raised all sorts of questions about the way the Communist Party traditionally viewed, and indeed Chairman Mao viewed, the lives of the people it was supposed to serve. But if someone with a really clear understanding of what it was like says to you that they still buy the official history, they still buy what you or I might regard as the spin, I sort of say, well, I stop there, that's not my business. My business is accuracy. Humility should prevent me from trying to go a bit further and get to what we might call truth. You'll notice that I have to say, rather skillfully, I think, I've managed to talk about spin by focusing on events that happened the other side of the world 80 years ago for some time without addressing Westminster politics at all. That's partly because, to be perfectly honest with you, it's quite difficult for people who still broadcast on the BBC, as I do, to talk about live political issues without getting into trouble. When we join, we have a surgical procedure to remove our capacity to have any remotely interesting opinion on a matter of public controversy. And we have to sign a contract promising that in the terrible event that any interesting thoughts do penetrate our brain, we'll keep them to ourselves. And actually, I think that's right. Being a broadcaster, news broadcaster, is a bit like being a novelist in the sense that the novelist asks you to suspend your disbelief when you read a story, and I ask you to go along with the idea that I don't actually have any views when you listen to me broadcast. And if I've written a virulent op-ed piece on some subject, that's extremely difficult to do, so it's fair enough, really. But with all those caveats in mind, I'll just finally make one Westminster-related point before I close. What I've tried to lay out this evening is what you might call a reporter's credo. Lots of my colleagues, as I said, certainly columnists and campaigning journalists, see what we do in a very different way. But I think the idea that accuracy trumps truth is also relevant to political interviewing. When I joined the Today team, the sainted John Humphreys gave me some very good hints about how you dig yourself out of trouble. And because the programme is both very long and very live, it's not unknown for presenters to be given an interview without actually being told what it's about. So somebody simply shouts in your headphones, "Go to Duncan Smith in the radio car," and that's it. And John's suggested solution to a crisis of this kind is to put on his most serious and concerned voice and say, Minister, this sounds important. In the vague hope that in the course of answering, the minister will tell you what on earth you're supposed to be talking about. Sue McGregor had a variation on this theme. She was doing an interview on a foreign story where she felt on shaky ground. She liked to bowl in a question along the lines of, that's all very well, but what about what's happening in the south of the country? You could actually conduct an entire interview with that kind of formula if you really wanted to. On any programme, you're doing a live interview, you're given what's called a brief, which is the same sort of thing as Her Eminence would have known as a lawyer. It's supposed to tell you everything you need to know to be the master of your subject for the 5 or 10 minutes that you're doing the interview or the discussion. There's a who section, which simply says the name, the title, and, of course, the relevance to the subject of the interviewee. There's a why section, which should state clearly the news development which makes the interview pertinent on that particular day. And then there's a what do we want section, which should give you a very clear idea of what the ambition for the interview is going to be, but which some producers like to use to put a list of their suggested questions. I'm not quite sure why, because none of us ever use them, but they do. Generally speaking, the quality of BBC producers is extraordinarily high, but just occasionally you encounter suggested questions that ring the alarm bells. Sometimes it's something along the lines of, but your critics say this is too little, too late, with no precision about who those critics are or why they might be arguing that. Sometimes it requires the interviewee to defend a ludicrous position, sets them up as an Aunt Sally. I was interviewing the Archbishop of Canterbury in the South Korean capital, Seoul, the other day, and the producer suggested an opening question along the lines of, what can the churches do to bring about the reunification of the two Koreas? Since he's only gone to Seoul for a couple of days for the World Council of Churches meeting, it's a bit rich to expect him to be able to solve one of the longest-running regional crises of the past half century. That's the sort of questioning that gets people angry, that leads to interviews descending into yarbooing, when you've got two people shouting at each other, or they're still over each other, so you can't actually hear what they're saying, in the political equivalent of the pantomime chorus of, oh yes it is, and oh no it's not. We do get criticised for that, and actually I think quite right too. What you yearn for in your brief, and I'm sure this is true of lawyers as well as presenters, is killer facts and killer questions, killer quotes rather, accurately recorded. Nothing stops a politician spinning as effectively as the short question which simply reminds the interviewee of an awkward fact or something that he or she said once upon a time which doesn't quite square with what they're saying now. I happened to be called off the subs bench to present The World at One, which Her Eminence mentioned, on the day of the most recent GDP figures, which some of you may remember last month showed growth rate for the quarter of 0.8%, which was generally taken as evidence of a reasonably healthy pace of economic recovery. And at the morning meeting, we were in some despair about the way we should cover this, because the usual ritual with GDP figures is to interview the Shadow Chancellor, Ed Balls, Chief Secretary of the Treasury, Danny Alexander, and when the political battles that are being fought are being fought over tiny bits of turf, which is certainly the case in economic policy under this government, you really do get to know the positions of the two sides very well indeed, the spin, if you like. And we could sit down at the morning meeting and we could pretty much predict what both of them would say when they came on the air. Ed Balls would tell us that living standards were still stagnant and that the impact of the recovery wasn't being felt by ordinary people. And Danny Alexander would project cautious optimism but still claim the figures as evidence for the government's economic strategy. And then, one of the producers came up with a wonderful killer quote for the Ed Balls interview, not unfortunately for the other one, but for the Ed Balls interview. Last year, the Shadow Chancellor said, we could well be in for a long, lost decade-style period of slow growth and high unemployment. So, I asked him whether he stood by that in the light of the morning's figures, which suggested an altogether more cheerful picture. And he didn't really answer, so I asked him again in a slightly different way, and he didn't answer again in a slightly different way. And I didn't get remotely close to Jeremy Faxman's famous interview with Michael Howard. But I asked him 4 or perhaps 5 times, and having that quote to hang on to, that verifiable, accurate fact to hang on to just lifted the event a bit. It just allowed me to make the sequence less of a kind of ritual rehearsal of preordained positions, which is the kind of thing that does annoy the listeners, quite rightly, I think. I think if you listen to Humphreys at his best, you'll hear whenever he's got something like that, whenever he's got a fact or a quote at his disposal, he keeps coming back to it. It's an incredibly effective way of doing an interview. Let's get the facts straight, Minister, and let the listeners decide what's true. More and more graduates are going into journalism, and there's a growing tendency to talk about it as a profession, like being a lawyer or a doctor. Part of the self-conscious anti-intellectualism of the old lags at ITN I recall with affection at the beginning of this talk was their insistence that journalism is a trade, not a profession. I think they were right, and I think carpentry, in a way, is the best metaphor for what we do. You can be an aspiring Chippendale. You can, of course, turn the table into something elaborately ornamented and beautiful. But if it's going to work at a table, it has to sit straight and not wobble. And that means being accurate with your tape measure, and the same applies to journalism.
Well, that was very interesting, very stimulating. The business of the pursuit of truth, of course, is one of the questions that's not just asked of journalists, it is asked of lawyers. You know, aren't you supposed to be, you know, discovering, you know, the truth? And in our case, it's not, absolutely not. And I have to always keep reminding people that we have a system that actually is not about pursuit of truth, because we recognise how slippery truth is. And therefore, our system is based on, deciding whether the proof of guilt by the state reaches the standard that's high enough. And you may be left with levels of uncertainty. But the idea that you can, as the European system claims to do, to go in pursuit of truth, is something that I think is an enigma.
But you do hear people talk about it in high-minded terms, certainly journalism, who say that is, that's why I come into journalism, to find the truth.
Yes. Speak truth to power.
A dangerous thing.
Speak truth to power. Okay, I'm sure that people want to come in on this. Please, let me see some hands. There's someone up there.
When you were talking about, you did some interviews, and one way of checking whether something was accurate was when two people reported a phone call from either side, and if they said roughly the same thing, it was a good indication that that was accurate.
Yeah.
So is one good way of increasing the amount of accuracy to have something that's corroborated rather than something that somebody, one person writes or there's one statement about? Is corroboration a good way of getting accuracy?
There used to be a great old rule in the BBC, always use two sources before you broadcast anything. That's rather gone by the fork. Actually, it's incredibly... the more you can corroborate, the better. The more you can double-check. Particularly things, odd enough, that seem reasonable to you. There's a great danger when you think you know a story well just to accept what somebody says or what you're told because it seems to fit the pattern. And to be lazy about checking because you think you know that subject. It's always worth going beyond and just double checking. I think the problem, or part of the problem, is today, if you work in things like rolling news, the pressure on you to get the stuff out quickly is so intense that it's quite difficult sometimes to do that. I was very lucky when I began at ITN because in those days there were only three television channels. And each one, certainly ITV and the BBC One, only had three news bulletins programmes a day. So if it happened between the end of the lunchtime, the bulletin at 1:30, and the 5:45 news, it didn't really happen. I mean, it didn't happen again until you were back on the air, so you had several hours in which to really nail it down. And people don't have that these days. And I think that is, it's very easy to slip into bad habits because there's that constant pressure on you to get there quickly. And we've all made terrible mistakes, we really have.
That pressure of the rolling news thing, maybe one of the reasons why we might be seeing perhaps less rigour,
But isn't the other thing that your career, I mean, when one looks at it, that you actually didn't know, but you did start. You were a graduate trainee. There was a training scheme. There were training schemes. You're not sure that it was such a great training scheme?
I mean, I was a BBC failure, I should say, when I went to the ITA scheme. The BBC training stream always was incredibly rigorous.
I've discovered something about the English upper classes, is that self-deprecation is what makes them so adorable.
Posh insult to them.
No, but you were a very clever guy. You went into the ITN, you got trained, or didn't you?
Well, we didn't really. I mean, that was one of the joys about the ITN system in those days. There were three of us, one of whom is now a master of Oxford College, Mark Lambson, who's at St. Peter's. One of whom is Michael Crick, who's a very distinguished journalist on Channel 4 News now. One was me, and they didn't really train us at all. They just gave us the rather sort of odd jobs like the ones I described at the beginning of my talk and let us learn on the job. But I think because it was still a very small organisation those days, because we didn't have the pressure of rolling news, and because they were fundamentally decent people, it was actually a bit like a sort of Oxbridge tutorial system. You had one-on-one training as you did the job. Yeah. But it didn't have that kind of formal training that certainly the BBC used to do, where you were given a course in journalistic law, where you were taken around all the regions, given the experience of local broadcasting and all that sort of thing. It was a bit ad hoc, if I'm honest.
Okay. And what about, I mean, do you believe in the journalism school? Because that's a new development, the idea that you do your degree and then you go off and do a master's or you do something in journalism at City University, right? I mean, what do you think of all that?
I mean, I am a bit of an old part about that, if I'm honest. I actually do think that it's something
you learn by doing it.
That's not to say that the training isn't very useful. It is. And particularly these days, technical training, I mean, skills in radio, which when I joined television, the journalists couldn't touch the equipment because the whole place would come out on strike. Mm-hmm. Nowadays, everyone multi-skills, and I think that's very healthy, so that sort of training is immensely valuable. I suppose my resistance to it is that it tends to make people think that it's a profession, like being a lawyer, like being a doctor, and that you can learn skills of a kind that are a bit more than just how you do it. I think the real secret of being a journalist is instinctive, but that is a very old-fashioned view of probably representative of my generation, not necessarily the truth. But it's
Someone, yes, please.
I was wondering whether illiteracy has become slightly more slippery concept. I'm thinking about instances where if something is reported by two reliable sources, even if it's wrong, it becomes right. So is accuracy slipping?
I'm not sure whether that's quite a difficult thing to measure, but I think the value of accuracy is actually growing in the internet age. And the great thing about an institution like the BBC is that even, or perhaps because of the plethora of outlets, people turn more and more to something they think they can trust. To go back to that word I used in the talk. You know, if you're flooded with sources of information, actually, in the end, you go to where you think you might find some old-fashioned professionalism, skills in assessing whether the information is right or not. And, you know, you go to the BBC website to check on something because it's the BBC and you know that it's gone through a certain process, or at least you hope it has. And by and large, I think it has. And it sometimes means that we are slower than other people. You can very often, I sometimes in the gym, have, you know, watch BBC on one outlet and Sky on the other, and you'll see that we're behind them. And actually, that's sometimes just because we're being a bit more careful, and no bad thing for that. I mean, that's our, you know, that's what keeps us alive.
Yes.
Well, thank you. Very interesting. Thank you very much. I just wanted to ask a bit more about this political interviewing, because I listen a lot to, you know, your programs and hear people like Caroline Quinn interviewing politicians, and I'm not actually convinced about whether this killer quote business being repeated is really, I think it's a bit annoying actually sometimes, but also what I wanted to ask was how much kind of independence do you have, because sometimes I think, oh, you know, she's had to ask that question because he said this, but was she told before that it would be okay to ask that question, or is she going off her own bat thinking of the questions? That's quite an interesting thing to know.
I think that the great secret of good political interviewing, actually all interviewing, is not the questions, it's listening to the answers.
Yeah.
I mean, all the really memorable interviews come when somebody says something that surprises you. And no amount of briefing, no amount of sort of pre-interview, strategic meeting with your boss can completely prepare you for the possibility that the interviewee is going to say something that takes you totally by surprise and actually makes the interview take light. And I suppose a couple, again, I'm a fan of Humphreys, so I'll give you a couple of examples. One was the George Entwistle interview, where you could tell as he was doing it that he didn't quite believe what he was hearing. And actually, one of the people who was in the studio at the time said that they just sort of felt, they felt the sort of the world changing as they sat there on the floor opening under George Entwistle's feet and you know, could sort of see the destruction happening. The other one, which perhaps illustrates the point about listening a bit better, was when some years ago when he was interviewing Claire Short, and I can't even remember what the interview was about, but she let slip in the course of the interview that the cabinet had seen intercept material from Kofi Annan's telephone. It wasn't what she was trying to say, she just mentioned this. And you could always hear the sort of Humphrey's brain where there's a you know, moment of dead time on the air. And they said, hang on, did you say what I think you just said? You're telling me we spy on the Secretary General of the United Nations. And the interview went off in a completely different direction. That was the story. And that's what you know makes a good interview. So yes, you plan ahead with your boss where you're going to go with the interview, although the sort of level of interview will dictate how much time you spend doing that. Yes, a good editor will listen very carefully and very occasionally, but only very occasionally, say in your ear, that's enough of that, or try on that. And you have to trust them because they're listening at one of you, or a good one is in the studio, and you know their judgment you have to trust.
Well, they can tell you as you're going
They can tell you, yeah. Uh-huh. But I mean, they've got to be very sparing with that because you've got to be listening. Absolutely, you've got to be on it all. It's very different. In television, you have what's called open talkback, where you can hear everything that's said in the gallery. And that can be quite frightening. I remember once when I was a newsreader, hearing the director say to the editor of the day, Amanda, if you don't make up your mind now, we are going to fall off the air. Mm-hmm. It's quite difficult to keep looking straight at the camera and not sort of shaking it when you get that. But in radio, so that you can focus on interviews, you have nothing until somebody just comes in. And if he's a good person, then he'll say, what about this? And you know, sometimes that can make all the difference.
And you can sometimes see it where somebody's interviewing and you know that they've written out all the questions,
yeah,
and they somehow move on to the next question.
Yes.
And you say, follow it, ask them, you know.
But you can hear that too.
Yeah.
I think if you listen, you can hear somebody and they, you know, the interviewee says something and they just say, but what about, yeah, it's terrible.
Yeah, it's terrible. Yeah.
I think.
Over here, please, in the front row, and then over to the gentleman.
Thank you. You just mentioned about letting slip, so I'd be grateful if what came to mind for me was Gordon Brown when he let slip to the Northern Lady, where Humphrey's conversation with the Northern Lady,
yeah,
and calling her a bigot. So have you ever been in that situation where you know the truth, but you have to communicate what you've been told?
Somebody was a bigot while I was interviewing them. What do you mean?
So Gordon Brown was in a situation where he'd conversed with a Northern Lady.
Yes,
I think the subject matter was immigration.
Yeah.
But when he got into the car,
yes,
he professed that this lady was a bigot.
Yes, yes.
And so my question to you is, have you ever been in a similar situation where you actually know what the truth is, but you've had to communicate what the official line, shall we say?
Well, it's a slightly different point. I mean, because I think that was a case of just forgetting how dangerous open microphones can be. And there are legion stories of people who forget their mics are open. I think the best one is the woman from CNN who went to the loo with her microphone on. But no, not on, what you might think. And was chatting to a friend of hers and discussing how ghastly her sister-in-law was. Suddenly threw the wrong switch and it went out over a Bush speech on the air, which is a bit unfortunate. But I tell you what I have, it goes back to this business of trying to pretend that you don't have views, or perform as if you don't have views. I was once interviewing a great friend of mine, a university friend, who's a Tory MP, I don't want to say his name, so it would embarrass him. And it was during the Duncan Smith period, and we'd been to stay over the weekend with them, a couple of weekends earlier. And he'd said to me, frankly, this Duncan Smith, the time's come to send the butler with a brandy and a revolver and get it over with. Anyway, he comes on the Today programme, having been put up by the whips as the Tory MP of the day who's going to defend Duncan Smith's leadership. And he's manfully trying to do this, and I'm trying to bite my lip and not say, come on, I know what you really think. And that's awkward, because one of the things I do feel very strongly is that there shouldn't be things that you know that the listener doesn't. It's unfair for the listener if they're presented with an interview which appears to be one thing on the air, but where maybe you've done a deal with the interview or something behind the scenes. I think that's fundamentally wrong. And just occasionally, like in situations like that, you find yourself inadvertently. That is very awkward, maybe, and you do your best to forget what you heard, forget the conversations that you had, forget the person as a friend, and just carry on as if none of that existed.
Okay. Then here, second row, then over here.
Yeah. Excuse my sore throat. Can I get back to striving for accuracy?
Yeah.
In purely journalistic terms, therefore, telephone hacking must be a really good idea and a really useful tool for journalists, but it's illegal. So where do moral judgments come into news gathering?
Well, actually, I don't think that's that difficult. We don't do things which are illegal. I mean, we just don't. I know there is.
I think legality makes that an easy answer.
I mean, if we lived in a country where the law routinely transgressed against the rights of citizens, it would be different. But by and large, we don't. And therefore, you know, legality, it seems to me, is. And I think one of the ironies about the current whole phone hacking debate is, and the regulation question is that a lot of the best revelations about all this stuff have come through the BBC and Channel 4, which are regulated industries. I mean, I will say no more than that, but I think it is worth noting that.
Thank you for a very good presentation. The accuracy of your replacement on the Today program, reported by the Mail. My question is, what has been your most unhappy experience vis-a-vis your most happy experience?
In broadcasting journalism?
Yes.
Well, I think the most testing experience, which is probably the most unhappy one on air, was when I was interviewing a French author called Michel Houellebecq, who had written a very scandalous novel about the 1960s, and it was completely disgusting and pornographic, really, but his argument was that it was a satire against the loose morals of the 1960s, which had corrupted today's youth, and so forth. And we had assigned a good chunk on a Saturday morning on the Today programme, a good 5-minute live interview with. And it became apparent within the first 30 seconds that he didn't actually speak English as such. So, there's just a hole. I mean, what do you do? So I asked longer and longer.
How's your French?
Well, my French is fine, but I wasn't sure about all the listeners. So I asked him, I sort of took a punt on the idea that he might understand English, and I asked him longer and longer questions, really requiring the answer, oui or non. And then I made the great mistake of risking it a bit. I said, well, Mr. Welbeck, many people will look at the more salacious sexual passages in your book and conclude that from being integral to the artistic message which you seem to convey, they are in fact simply pornographic. But of course, it is just pornography. That's why we went to sport earlier.
So what about a really great experience, a fun, terrific experience?
Fun, terrific experience. I don't know, very often it's so much fun, but some of the most moving interviews you do are actually with ordinary people who speak from the heart and are caught up in extraordinary situations. I remember once doing, there was a pair of twins, both of whom had been sent to Iraq, and one of them was killed on their birthday, and his brother and their father came on the radio a year later to talk about what it would be like, and they just spoke so straightforwardly and naturally, without any, without any attempt to over-dramatise, but with great dignity, that you thought this is just
perfect,
pure radio gold. I mean, I hate to use that phrase over something so important, but it was the sort of, many more people got in touch after that interview than after, say, the Prime Minister or something like that.
colleague up there.
Thank you very much for this inspiring talk. I just wanted to dwell on the notion of accuracy a bit. Would you say that being accurate can be objective? Or would you say that by already picking certain facts and sort of prioritizing certain facts over others, prioritizing certain arguments and frames over others, you already kind of introduce a certain subjectivity to your report?
Inevitably, you do that a bit. One of the points that was made a lot when I started in journalism was that we always reported interest rates rises as good as bad news and interest rates drops as bad news, because we all had mortgages and therefore that's the way we saw the world. And if the programmes had been run by pensioners who saw things the other way around, the reporting would have been in the other direction. But you can't be perfect, but I think you can if you keep self-censoring yourself all the time. And again, I think objectivity falls slightly into the truth bracket. If you keep coming and saying, what can I really say that's sure? What can I say that is not, that you can't challenge, that I'm absolutely confident about? You kind of sort of get there in the end. It isn't ever perfect. You're bound to skew things a bit. And let's face it, we are all who we are, and however hard we pretend not to have convictions and views, we do. And that is bound to, you know, a little bit in some way inform the judgments we make, but you have to be quite tough on yourself all the time. And after a long time in journalism, I think you get that habit of mind. It's not entirely healthy. A lot of us find it almost impossible to believe anything because we always think the opposite to whatever it is we're told, just on, you know, out of habit. It's a slightly odd habit of mind. You're always challenging whatever argument you read or whatever anyone says to you. But I think you can get close. It's like that thing, risking outside my comfort zone, but calculus, where you're trying to measure the gradient of a circle, and you can't actually do it, but you can just get closer and closer to it, and that's sort of what journalism is like, good journalism anyway.
But in that thing of you're always questioning and pushing yourself in each direction, I mean, it's my experience that a lot of journalists end up being very cynical.
No, I think that's true. I think there's a real danger there. And there's also, I mean, particularly politicians, there can be a tendency to assume that they're all rogues. Lying. Yeah, which I think is wrong. I mean, I think that is something you have to go up against. Mm.
Now, there was a hand there, this young lady. Thank you.
I just wanted to bring it back to the football analogy in your speech. You said that people wanted the football results because they understood them, and if they knew that you'd got those rights, then they trust you when it came to matters that they didn't understand themselves. But when it comes to these matters that, you know, every ordinary people don't understand, then don't you think the truth is sort of required as well as the accuracy? Like, you have to provide something more, because otherwise the accuracy won't be relevant to them and they won't think it matters.
Of course you have to provide context. Of course you have to provide people with the information they need to understand the importance of the story, but that's not quite the same as claiming to speak truth in a sort of preaching, crusading way. I mean, you can say, look, Syria matters to you because X, Y, and Z. And that has to be accurate. You don't have to sort of go on, and therefore we must all go off and send troops there or whatever it is. That's the sort of distinction I'm talking about. I'm not saying that you limit yourself to very, very basic facts. Of course context matters, but it's just a question of the way you dress something up. Dress it up only with an intention to give people the information they need to make up their own minds, not to try and influence the way they do that.
I saw in the paper in the last 24 hours, I mean, either today or yesterday, I think that was looking, analysing those who are asked onto television and radio programmes, you know, as the two voices of, you know, to provide you with the two sides of a story. And what was very interesting was that they looked at the percentage of trade unionists, for example, whoever are invited onto the Today programme or onto, and they found, and it's incredibly low. And so, you know, it was analysing basically who are invited on. And yes, we can get the Ed Balls and the guy from the Treasury, but and let me assure you, we the listeners also know what they're going to say before they come on.
Right.
but what we would like be interested to hear from is somebody who would give us a different view from those pundits. We'd like to hear from, you know, how is this really going to affect the lives of working folk? You know, how is this really going to impact? And we don't want to hear it from people who've been given a line by the party, whichever party it is. We want to hear it from more people. And it was shown that actually there isn't enough of a reach to those other voices.
I think that is, to some extent, inevitable, but it's also something we always have to go against. And the good illustration, I think, of how it can be a problem, how it can lead us to get things fundamentally wrong, is Europe. In the last days of the Thatcher major years, Eurosceptics who questioned the euro were regarded by many people as a bit loopy and weren't invited on the air very often. Now,
they're on the air
all
the time.
You have to say it, they may have been right. Do you see what I mean? And I think that we have to be constantly conscious of the fact that just because somebody isn't part of the mainstream, they're not always wrong.
But there's a debate in this, which is that what do you do? I mean, that business of neutrality sometimes itself is a myth, because I remember being invited to a seminar at the BBC where they invited some outsiders in to be around folk like you to sort of start challenging and questioning the assumptions. And one of the things was, this was some years ago, could you really be neutral on apartheid in South Africa? I mean, was it necessary to have somebody on the other side saying,
no, of course not.
There must be some issues on which the idea of going to two sides is a nonsense, right?
Yes, yeah.
And so, but I mean, for example, there is a question just now around the science on global warming.
Yeah.
And yet, Nigel Lawson is regularly on the Today programme presenting his views, saying that the global warming is a fiction, yet 95% of scientific research suggests that is a serious issue.
But global warming is obviously classically one where I think you have to come back to what you can accurately report. Mm-hmm. I mean, that's, you know, this is the science. You make up your minds, I'm not going to say. And where there is room for different interpretations, it's quite right that one has people on, you know.
As long as we point out very clearly that they represent 5%.
Well, we should always point out what people represent, and particularly when they have financial interests or something of that kind. I mean, that is really important.
Someone with a hand up there.
Sorry for asking a second question. The thing about accuracy, and it's when you talked about the euro, it's quite easy to be accurate about, potentially easy to be accurate about the past or the present. It's more difficult to be accurate
about the future.
You can't be accurate about the future. So the debate about whether joining the euro was a good or bad thing, how can you be accurate about that when you're not in
So
can I just finish? If accuracy isn't possible, which it isn't, for the future, what do you do about things which are discussing potential futures? Accuracy can't be the measuring stick.
No, I think that's right. There isn't a good answer to that. The point I was really trying to make was that we do all the time have to be conscious. I mean, this is not actually the sort of decision I have to make, the sort of decision editors have to make, rather than me. But we do all the time have to be conscious of the danger of excluding people from the airwaves or the newspaper pages or whatever it is, because the consensus says that they're mad or loopy. You know, sometimes they're...
Sorry, and that's... I shouldn't use the analogy. That's the question more simply. What do you do about issues which are to do with the future where you haven't got the facts on which you can base accuracy?
You use your best judgment with what you have got to try and... I mean, in terms of deciding who you ask on.
No, it's like... What's right or wrong?
Well, you can't, can you? Well, you can. I mean, you can to some extent. You can, as I said with the Iraq story that I referred to, you can say, look, I've looked at all the facts, and it seems to me most likely that this is what's going to happen. I mean, we did it the other day with a programme on Syria. We looked at the evidence that the sort of old Sykes-Picot borders that were drawn up in the Middle East in 1916, I think it was, or 17 years ago, are going to disappear. And the evidence that that's going to happen is actually quite strong. You can see the border between Iraq and Syria already disappearing. You can see the border with Lebanon becoming increasingly porous, these borders were created by us in a region of the world which, where they didn't really mean very much in terms of dividing different peoples and so forth. And you could put a jigsaw together and you can say, well, I mean, I'm not saying this is going to happen, but looking at the evidence, there's quite a good chance that it will. And that seems to be a perfectly legitimate exercise, and one which, again, it's not saying this will happen, but it's saying, based on what I can see at the moment, that's the nearest I can come to an accurate prediction about the future. Shaking his head, never mind.
I think, to be honest, I think people become very subjective about the future based on a lot of their hidden motives and things they're not really conscious about.
Well, that
I'll give you a very simple example.
Well,
the Israel-Palestine issue. One side thinks something happened as a catastrophe. The other side thinks it was the fantastic independence. So it's very hard to bring to have a future prediction which can encompass two diverse views of the past.
Can I just ask you, what is your definition of truth?
No, you can't. I wouldn't dream of saying that in Oxford. I'll get into terrible trouble.
And a young woman up here, please, thank you. On the aisle, and then across from, up there, dark here.
With regard to what you were saying about withholding opinion, how do you negotiate that sort of necessary compartmentalisation between, you know, the magnanimous journalist and the human being that has opinions? I mean, is there a sense that once you have published that opinionated op-ed, that's it, your credibility is shot? And what kind of methods do you use to cope with holding back on personal opinions?
It's just self-discipline, I think. Every so often, I mean, one of my colleagues, I'm sure you won't mind me referring to this, although I won't name, got into terrible trouble because he was interviewing a Labour Party politician, and he's known to be, thought to be a Labour sympathiser, and he said, what happens if we lose the next election?
We know who that was.
And we love him, don't we?
Yes, we do.
But I mean, you know, you just have to be very careful not to do that kind of thing. And my kind of yardstick is, if you listen to this interview, can you tell that I conducted it in a particular way because I am a particular person with particular views? And for example, weirdly, though we are not allowed, quite rightly in my view, to admit whom you vote for, or what party you might support.
Or not vote at all if you're
we're quite open about our religious affiliation. Okay? I make no secret of the fact that I'm a Catholic. Now, when I do interviews on the Sunday programme, I am particularly conscious, particularly if it's a subject, you know, if it's the Archbishop of Westminster or something, that people might listen to that and think, he's only saying that because he's one of them. And I try very, very hard to make sure that there's nothing there that they can seize on to allow them to do that.
There's one last question there, sorry. Before you come in, yes?
Is there a sense that... I mean, is there a particular space where you can give your opinions as a journalist? For example, you were saying that, you know, in an interview or if you're doing a report, you have to be as neutral as possible. Is there another space where you can give your opinion without that affecting the rest of your work? Can you publish
when
that?
He's having a drink?
I'll give you an illustration of that, because when I lost my job on the Today programme, Daily Telegraph very kindly got in touch and they said, look, you're very popular with our readers, we'd love you to write a column. So I went on to the BBC and I said, how about you? And they said, well, I'm terribly sorry. You may think we're owing you this because we've just deprived you of a large part of your income, but the fact is you are still signed up to our editorial principles, and no, you can't. They said, but here's a copy of the editorial guidelines. Go away and read them, and if you can find a loophole, we'll be sympathetic. And I discovered a line that says, you know, clause 32, subsection B, whatever it was, this stricture does not apply to lifestyle. I have a dog, still do have a dog. So I imposed to the Telegraph that I should write a column about walking the dog. And amazingly, they bought it.
I love dogs!
But the point is, you know, I was able to find a way of saying a little bit about sort of odd subjects through the dog. On the basis that, you know, somebody's not likely to say in the middle of an interview about the GDP, but I know you'd say that because of what you said about your dog. Do you know what I mean? So in an extreme way, there are little corners that you can escape to.
There's a debate about dangerous dogs in the House of Lords just now.
And well,
the controversies around dogs will come and bite you. Yes, please.
I wondered when you interview politicians, perhaps, or others, do they ever make conditions about what they will talk about when they come on air? And if so, do you agree to that?
They try to, and that isn't done by me, that is done by editors. The general principle is that if it's a cabinet minister, they should be able to answer questions on absolutely anything that you throw at them. There's a presumption that if somebody comes on the air to talk about the announcement of, national health policy, and it's the health secretary or whatever, you will at least give them the time to look at that properly in a way that, you know, gives the subject a proper looking. But if you then say, and what about John Major and his comments about the class-bound society that we still live in, that's absolutely fair game. So that's the, you know, I think, and it also depends, I say, give an example of cabinet ministers, I think it depends a little bit as you go down the order, down is not quite the right word, but if you're talking to somebody who's on just because of a personal experience, it's reasonable for them to expect you to just talk to them about that and not throw them a googly at the end. And if it's an ordinary backbench MP, you know, it's somewhere between the two things. The one thing I always insist on is, I mean, for example, I'm just looking at the running order for this weekend's Sunday programme, and one of our guests who's a minister will not discuss with an MP from another party, so we've got him on after her. And I will make sure that I say on the air so the listeners know she wouldn't talk to him, so we're talking to him separately. So I think as long as you're upfront about anything like that, it's
fine. Why do they do that?
I don't know. You're going to be a politician.
Not a politician. But I sometimes do go on things and you know, when I've been criticising David Blunkett or something, and they don't want it to be a debate.
I think some of them have a very strong sense of their own dignity.
Well, they may feel like you're going to make mincemeat of them.
They may also. In your case, I'm sure that's true. But there's a sort of thing, you know, a cabinet minister will often feel it's fair enough he's going to debate in his opposite number, but not if he's going to debate with somebody a bit further down.
I see.
I mean, there's a bit of that that goes on. But very often it is because they don't like the idea that their arguments are going to be. And you do sometimes have to make a decision. Are we going to have them on at all? Or are we just, you know.
A hand's going up there.
So this quest for accuracy is, and certainly the placement of accuracy over truth, how does that change, or how is that more relative, or is relative to the media you're working in? So is it easier on the radio, or is it more difficult?
I'm not sure. I think radio is a more flexible medium than television in lots of ways. It's a much more ideas-friendly medium. You could explore things in a more discursive way, and I suppose that does make it easier thing to put things in context. Television is very much narrative-driven, you know, and it's picture-driven. You learn very early on, you know, if your words fight the pictures will always win. Radio is completely different. Well, obviously, it's different, but it's noticeable. When I used to work in television, as a newscaster, people would say, "Oh, that was an appalling tie you were wearing today." When you work at the radio, people will say to you, "I really didn't like that question you asked the Prime Minister this morning." It's a much sort of more of an intellectual engagement, and also a more personal kind of engagement with the thing. People feel they know you better. It's a warmer medium, and it's in your living room. You know, if telly, particularly in the old days, you sat down and you watched it, there's a certain formalness about it and a certain distance between you and performance, and the radio is much more sort of as if somebody's with you and chatting to you. That doesn't quite answer your question, but it's
very interesting and helpful. Well, listen, I think that was wonderful, and it's so interesting to hear someone who grapples with those issues, and it's important for us to know that that's what's going on with good journalism. So thank you.
Well, that was great fun. Thanks very much.